I want to begin by turning to Mark chapter 6, if you could find Mark 6 and verse 30 and following. I just want to frame this conversation in something we see Jesus doing here that I think is really wonderful. So Mark chapter 6, verse 30. Jesus has just sent out the apostles and they've been out doing their thing and they come back. In Mark chapter 6, verse 30, we read, "The apostles returned to Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught." And I remember the first time I read that verse, I remember thinking, okay, that is what Sunday evenings are for if you're a pastor. That's when you, in effect, return to Jesus and you get to say to Jesus, hey, this is what happened today. You download the ministry day to Jesus. We get to do that. Verse 31, "Jesus said to them, 'Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while, for many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat.'" Now, I know what I'm like. If I have too much people stuff, I start to get low energy. If I add to that I'm hungry, it's not a pretty sight. It's not a good combination. So I know how I would be feeling at this stage. So verse 32, "They went away in a boat to a desolate place by themselves." Fantastic. Problem solved. All good. Except verse 33, "Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them." Darn it. That's not good. Then Jesus goes ashore. So here's what I want you to think. You're hungry. You've just peopled out completely. Jesus comes ashore and he sees a great crowd. And he had compassion on them. I would be irritated. Actually, I frequently am if I get stuck in traffic. All those other people are in my mind, they're simply an impediment to where I want to get to. But when Jesus sees this crowd, he has compassion. He's not irritated by them. He doesn't scold them. He has compassion on them, we're told, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So here's something we need to bear in mind. When Jesus sees the lostness of the lost, he has compassion. As we see a lost culture becoming seemingly more and more lost, there are too many Christians who are responding to that by being angry at the culture. That the one who has the right to be angry is Jesus, and he's compassionate. I doubt we are going to achieve through our anger what Jesus achieves through compassion. Next thing to notice just from this verse is, what does this Jesus who is filled with compassion do? End of verse 34, he began to teach them many things. He's going to feed them in a moment as well. They need that too. But the first thing Jesus does in his compassion is to teach them of himself. Not just to teach them one thing, but to teach them many things. We have many things to keep teaching the world around us about Jesus. We don't just have one prepackaged kind of, okay, this is the Jesus thing I'm going to teach you, and if that doesn't work, I'm moving on. But actually, we have many things to keep coming back to people with about Jesus. So that's what we're longing for with our LGBTQI friends. We're longing for them, out of our compassion, for them to come and know the Jesus who's shown himself to us. This, when I was working with RZIM a few years ago, they asked me to speak on the subject of how can I know my gender. We were doing a series called Trending Questions, and each one of these was meant to be a kind of, here's a response to something people are kind of thinking through in our culture at the moment. It was one of these events that was going to be a bit in person, but mainly live streamed. And so in the run-up to it, they were advertising it, trying to sort of let people know that this was going on. And my initial goal for the event was, okay, here's an area where culture's confused. What unique Christian insights can we bring to the conversation to help our secular friends give Jesus a second thought? As the event approached, the ministry began to get messages from parts of the Christian world saying, what on earth are you doing asking that question? What a stupid question. Why are you taking it seriously? just tell people to look underneath their trousers and there's nothing more to be said. And some people said, we're never going to support this ministry ever again. We can't believe you sold out. And Jesus to our non-Christian. It made me realize, okay, we now have two aims for this event. One is, again, to try to commend Jesus to our non-Christian friends who were wrestling with that question. The second aim is we need to help Christians understand why people are asking that question. Because if we think the question our friends have, the questions our friends have is ridiculous, we're less likely to have a compelling answer to that question. And I don't know about you, maybe this is just me, but I've yet to hear of someone being ridiculed into the kingdom. Maybe that person exists. But if we think that the questions our friends are asking are ridiculous, we're unlikely to have a compelling answer. We need to try and understand why is that question of all questions weighing heavily on the hearts and minds of our friends? Something has made that question feel obvious and urgent. And unless we understand that kind of background, we're not going to be able to really help them with the question. So here's why we're spending the first part of this session on understanding our culture, because what has been going on inside that person's mental furniture to make that question seem like the obvious one? Lots of things have happened in the last 10, 15, 20 plus years. I just want to pick out four things that have changed that help me make sense of some of the questions our LGBTQI friends are asking. So here's the first thing. Our view of sexuality has changed. That's not breaking news. I think you knew that. And what we mean by that is essentially that, in addition to what we were thinking about earlier in terms of sexual identity and that kind of thing, sex itself has now been almost entirely uncoupled from procreation, and for many people is simply a means of recreation and should never have to be anything more than that. The not having to be more than that part is central to people today, because fulfilling your sexuality is one of the ways you express who you are. It's one of the ways you kind of self-actualize. It's something that is meant to be a form of transcendence in a culture that's almost rejected that concept. And so sexual freedom is seen as essential. And anything that looks like it might be a threat to sexual freedom is an existential threat. Which is why when it comes to issues like abortion, it's never ultimately about the status of the unborn child. The more we know about the unborn child and what the child can experience and even feel pain and all those things, that's not the issue. Because the issue really is the perceived right to sexual freedom. So our view of sexuality has changed. Secondly, our view of marriage has changed. Not simply that we now have same-sex marriage legalized in our countries. There was a more significant shift, I want to suggest, that went on sometime earlier than that, which is marriage moved from being lifelong, covenantal, and ordered towards procreation, even if it didn't always result in that, to now being effectively a flexible romantic contract. In other words, it's not about what you're promising, it's about how you're feeling. It's a flexible romantic contract because marriage is essentially a way of celebrating mutual romantic fulfillment. And it's a contract because for as long as we're both feeling romantically fulfilled, great, we'll hang in there. But the moment one or both of us isn't, we don't need to stick around. And if I'm going to follow my heart and be true to myself, I shouldn't stick around. Now, if that is what marriage has functionally come to mean, then if it's about celebrating romantic fulfillment, then it feels cruel and unusual not to allow certain other relationships to have their moment in the sunshine too. As an ordained clergyman, I occasionally get to take weddings, and I love doing so. It's a great perk. But one of the conditions now, if a couple at church asks me to take their wedding, that one of my conditions is I'd be absolutely thrilled to, but please don't write your own vows. Because the only time I've seen people write their own vows, the vows they write entirely miss the point of the marriage ceremony. It's about how you feel. And guess what? It's your wedding day. We know how you feel. And we don't need 13 verses of bad poetry to know that you guys are into each other. But because that's the sort of ground level definition of marriage we're operating with, it feels unjust not to allow same-sex couples, or for that matter, thruples or whatever else, to call their romantic fulfillment marriage as well. So our view of marriage has changed. Next, our view of minorities has changed. We now look back at past discrimination against, particularly against LGBTQI folks. We look back at past discrimination and feel a very deep sense of collective regret in the West. We look at the pain caused by previous, you know, laws against homosexual intimacy. We think about the, you know, people like Alan Turing, the movie The Imitation Game. We think about how we treated people back then, and we feel shame. And as Christians, I think we share some of that regret. We look at some of those previous laws, and we feel again that wasn't right. And as we look back and feel that sense of regret, what it then fuels is a desire to make sure previously victimized minority groups are now given special attention and protection. And so we have what is often described as the idea of intersectionality, which means that if you belong to a minority and victim group, you have a more privileged position in the public square than someone who does not. Part of the thinking, as I try to understand it, is something like this. If you're standing on the street, and you're just standing on the edge of a street, and there's one street, you can see in two directions. If you stand at an intersection, you can see in many more directions. And so if you're someone who is at the intersection of more than one minority status, the idea is you have unique insight and understanding that nobody else does, and so your voice needs to be privileged more than anybody else's. Which means it's no longer a level playing field. Some people have more right to speak and some people have less right to speak. If you belong to more than one minority group, that particularly if it's been historically kind of victimized, you have more moral authority. Which means if you are a black female lesbian, you have more moral authority when it comes to issues of sexuality than someone who is white, male, and straight. That's the world in which we live. As I've tried to think that through, I've been trying to think, okay, how can I use that mindset to try and commend the gospel? Well, here are a couple of thoughts I've got on that. One is, there's a sense in which Jesus found himself on the rough end of virtually every social dynamic he belonged to. He belonged to a race that was being oppressed, the Jews. Within that race, he was actually a minority within a minority because he was then being oppressed by them as well. So if your metric for what makes someone worth listening to is oppression and being treated unjustly, that means you should be listening to Jesus more than anybody else. And if the point of being on an intersection is you can see in more directions than everybody else, well, Jesus is Google Earth. And see, he is above and able to see along all of those things. But more than that, if part of the kind of unspoken premise behind intersectionality is, okay, you white guys can't be trusted with power anymore, we need to give it to someone else. If it's always seeing the world as oppressor versus victimized, what we really need is someone who is able to show us how to use power in a way that is sacrificial and actually is of benefit to those who are powerless, which is exactly what we have in the gospel. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. The more we understand the servanthood of Jesus, the more within our own church roles and leadership positions and all the rest of it, the more safe we should be given authority. We should be safe people to give authority to, because we won't be using it to throw our own weight around. We won't be using it to boost our own grandiosity. We will be using it to say no to self and to serve other people who are less powerful. Those are just some thoughts on that. Out of this view of minorities comes a concern for harm. I was giving a talk at a university in the States just before COVID, and I was invited onto campus just by the kind of regular Christian group on campus. They had a weekly teaching session. They asked me to come and speak at it and to speak on the gospel and sexuality. It wasn't intended to be a kind of a wide open public event, although anyone would have been welcome. But it was primarily, here's a chance for the Christians on campus to think through this particular issue. Word somehow got out that this topic was being addressed and that I was the one addressing it, and a campus-wide call was made for protests. And so there were a dozen or so students there to protest the event. Now, what is wonderful about student protesters is that they are the only ones who were there before the event starts. So for about 20 minutes, it was just me and them and no one else. So I had a good amount of time to talk with them. And they were absolutely delightful. I mean, when I was a kid, I did some protesting myself. I like protesters. And they were sweet. They shared their pizza with me, and they weren't unfriendly. But I said to them, listen, I'd love to hear what your concerns are. If you feel able to give voice to those, I'd love to hear what your concerns are. And the theme that came out as we kind of went around the group was, we think your words are going to do harm. And when I kind of asked them to sort of unpack what they meant, it basically meant, I began to realize harm was the presence of disagreement. Even if that disagreement was being graciously expressed, the mere presence of it was deemed psychologically harmful. And the penny dropped in my mind, and I thought, oh, well, of course, yes, because if my position is just by its existence causing harm to minority groups who've historically been marginalized and victimized, then I don't need to be out-argued, I don't need to be out-debated, I just need to be silenced. And hence we have this culture of censorship and cancelling. And then finally, our moral intuitions have changed. Some of you will have come across the writer Jonathan Haidt and his book, The Righteous Mind, which has been such a helpful book for me in understanding some of these cultural dynamics. Because Haidt basically says one of the reasons people are unable to talk to each other these days is because they're operating from different moral intuitions. In other words, the moral taste buds that help us instinctively sense whether something is morally right or wrong, he says, those moral taste buds have actually changed over the last 20 years. And we see that when you go back 25 years maybe, most people thought marriage was between a man and a woman and that gay marriage wasn't right. Just at an instinctive level, it didn't seem right. Today, that's totally changed. And it's not because people have read lots of books on ethics. It's because their moral intuitions have changed. And the moral intuition that is kind of more kind of prominent is, is this harmful or not? Is this oppressive or not? Is this fair or not? And so when people think about gay marriage, they think, well, it's not harming anybody else. So how can we say it's wrong if it's not harming anyone? How can we deny them the human right to find love and express that love as they choose when we have other people being given that right? How can it be fair if they can't marry but somebody else can? Now, this is significant for us. There's a BBC show where there's some moral issue on the table. They get different people to speak to it from different perspectives. The audience weighs in with questions and comments, and it kind of turns into a punch-up, and that's the show. That's the whole point of it, the good old argument. And a few years ago, they had this particular show on the issue of, should the church embrace gay marriage? Not just should culture, but should the church? And one of the people speaking in favor was a lady who's a kind of prominent gay rights activist within the church. She calls herself an evangelical. Her basic point was, you know, God is love. This is love. God blesses it. The church should too. And you could see the audience completely track with her. The guy who was speaking on behalf of a more traditional kind of Christian position was being faithful. And it's all very easy for me to say this when I'm sat on the armchair watching from the comfort of home. But his response was always, yeah, but the Bible says, and the Bible says, and the Bible says. And he's right, the Bible does say. But he was appealing to a moral authority that the audience did not share. He was talking past them. And I'm sure he went home that day and thought, you know, I think I was faithful. In one sense, he was. But I think faithfulness is doing everything that we can to make sure we're able to commend the wisdom and truth and goodness of God in ways people will actually be able to understand. And if we're not understanding the moral intuitions people have, we're just going to be talking past them. And being faithful isn't just that we're saying the right things, but we're trying to do everything we can to make sure they are hearing and understanding God's truth. So a lot of things have changed. The upshot of all of that, as I was saying earlier, is that we're no longer seen as quaint and old-fashioned. We're seen as dangerous. And don't you miss the days of being quaint and old-fashioned? Those were the good old days, it turned out. But now people see us as unfair and unloving and harmful. And these changes are changes many of us have seen. And therefore we are migrants into this new cultural moment. It's not where we've come from. For many people in our churches, particularly those under sort of 2025, they are natives to this cultural moment. This is the only culture they've ever known. And many of their intuitions are lined up with these changes. And even those who've been raised in Christian homes have been more shaped by their smartphone than they have by their church community. Which means I think we're sitting on something of a demographic time bomb. And there'll be a lot of people in our churches that might be biblically convinced on what we think about sexuality and gender identity, but they're not emotionally convinced. And if they're not emotionally convinced, I don't think they're going to remain biblically convinced. And we need to remember that because we are immigrants into this culture and they are natives, we are dealing, even within our own families, with a cross-cultural situation. And one of the mistakes I think the church has made in recent years is simply thinking, well, this is what I was told when I was that age and it worked for me, so I'll just do the same thing for these guys. And we're not recognizing we're actually ministering to a new culture. And 30 years ago, someone at the youth group saying, you know, well, it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, that might have worked. That is not going to work today. So we do need to understand culture as well as we can. So I hope that's given us a kind of sobering view of where we're at and what we're up against. That's kind of my intention to a little bit depress us. Given that, how do we begin to respond? How can we begin to speak the truth of Jesus Christ into this kind of culture? Well, the first thing to say is, I'm excited about the culture we're in. Not because I think it's great, but because I think this is an amazing time to be a Christian. There's that line in Hamilton where they've just had the Declaration of Independence. The English Army is about to kind of turn up in New York Harbor. And they're singing, look around, we're so lucky to be alive at a time like this. I would not want to be a Christian at any other time than right now. I think it's going to get harder for us, and I think it's going to be amazing for the gospel. So what do we need to do? Well, firstly, we need to listen well. Proverbs gives us some wisdom here. So Proverbs 18 verse 13. This is a verse for pastoral ministry and not just evangelism. But Proverbs 18 verse 13 says, if one gives an answer before he hears, it's his folly and shame. If one gives an answer before he hears, it is his folly and shame. And if you know the book of Proverbs, you know folly and shame are big categories. Those are serious words. So we need to make sure that we're actually listening to people. Which means if I have the opportunity of meeting an LGBTQI individual, the first thing I want to do is if I can grab a coffee with them, I just want to hear their story. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on this and how you've come to be where you are on this, because the more I hear from their story and their journey and their background, the more that's going to inform how I then begin to respond. Again, Proverbs 20, verse 5, the purpose in a man's heart is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out. In other words, what you're seeing is often just the surface, and there's a whole superstructure under the surface that needs to be understood. There's more going on under the surface than we are aware of. And it can take time to find out what the issue really is with someone. We know that in pastoral ministry. I remember chatting with a guy who turned up at church once, and he said he wanted to. It's amazing, actually. He said, I'd love to. He said, would it be okay if we maybe grab lunch one day and you told me a bit more about what it is to follow Jesus? Would that be all right? I'm like, well, I'll ask, but I think I might be able to get permission for that one. And he shared that he was a gay man. He'd been in a long-term relationship, and he wanted to sort of, he was just beginning to sort of think about Christian things. And I asked him just to share a bit of his story. And realized in the course of his story, this is someone who had been profoundly hurt over the years. He was a tender soul. And as that hurt began to come out, I just had this sense, he needs to know that Jesus is the one who will not break a bruised reed. Jesus is someone we can trust our deepest wounds to. With someone else, as they share their story, I may have a very different starting point. If there's someone who's confused about their identity, I may start with the woman at the well. Because when she met Jesus, her first response was to say to her friends, come and meet a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Christ? There are so many potential starting points, and so we need to listen well to people. Secondly, this is a MO that I have come across over the years, really by making mistakes and then doing a replay and thinking, what should I have done in that situation? And this is the out there is that we are unjust, that we discriminate. We have one kind of gospel for straight people and one gospel for everybody else. So people are expecting there to be some kind of fundamental differentiation that we're going to make when we meet someone who's LGBTQI. And so I try and head that off at the very beginning by operating according to this principle. Don't say to someone what you can't say to everyone. So after a talk I gave once, this was a campus somewhere, a girl came up and said, I'm a lesbian. What do you think about that? I said, well, nice to meet you. Thank you for saying hi and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I said to her, you know, Jesus has some really challenging things to say to all of us about sexuality. She said, why? What does he say? I said, well, he kind of says we're broken in this part of life. And we had a conversation trying to unpack what that meant. And at no point in the conversation did I mention anything specific about her lesbianism. The reason is because if I had answered her question by saying, well, the Bible says being a lesbian is a sin, what she would have heard was that she was being singled out, that she was being looked down upon, that she was going to be treated differently to everybody else. And I thought, for her to know what the gospel says to her, she needs to hear how the gospel lands on all of us first. Similarly, another time at a Q&A, someone asked a question, do gay people go to hell, yes or no? And I remember thinking, neither syllable I'm being offered there really does justice to what I actually want to say on this. So I said, well, if there's no hope for gay people, there's no hope for anyone. Because we're all in the same boat. One time I met a student. I was speaking at a university. I don't know how this happened, but I was asked to speak to a campus LGBTQI advocacy group. You know, this is the student group on campus, and this evangelical idiot was being let in to speak to them all. And I gave a presentation. There was a time for Q&A. As you can imagine, a lot of the questions had some topspin. But I had a chat to someone afterwards. I met this student came up to me afterwards, and he said, I'm not at this university, but I was the president of the LGBT group at a different college in town here. And he said, I'm not a Christian, I'm gay. I've read your book on this, and I'm going through Mark's gospel with a pastor at a church, and I'm going to the Bible study group. And I was like, okay, you're doing more Christian stuff than most church members I know. So I said, what has got you thinking about the Christian faith? What is drawing you to that? And he said, well, I realize Jesus treats me the same as he treats everybody else. And I said, why does that so precious to you? And he said, well, when I was the president of this LGBTI group, the whole thing was, we're different. We're special. We need to be treated differently. And he said, you know, when Pride Month would come out, we'd sort of think, okay, which companies can we guilt into giving us the most stuff? And he said, but then I realized that I don't want to be different. And it just struck, the irony struck me that there is more equality with Jesus Christ than there is in a secular culture that prides itself on equality. And Jesus really does put us all in the same boat. If I get to teach evangelistically on sexuality, I go to Matthew 5, 27, 28, Jesus saying, you know, you've heard that it was said, do not commit adultery. But I say to you, anyone who looks lustfully has committed adultery in their heart. Jesus is just assuming the human heart is adulterous. We misuse our and other people's sexuality. So what Jesus says on this issue, if we rightly understand it, will challenge and humble every single one of us. Which means we don't ultimately look down on other people because of their kind of sexual sin. We're too conscious of our own. I was doing a seminar for some pastors in England, and one of the pastors just blurted out in the Q&A, how can you talk to a gay person without being disgusted by them? Well, thanks for being honest. And there are lots of things I could have said, but what I said to him was, by being more disgusted by your own sin, brother. It's not that all sin is exactly the same. It isn't. But when Jesus promises that the Spirit is going to come to convict of sin, he's not meaning the Spirit will come and convict you of everybody else's sin. And the sin that we should always be most distressed about, most exercised about, is our own. Because we see our own hearts. We don't see into other people's. And so if I find your sin more problematic than mine, and I'm only just seeing the surface of you and I'm seeing the depth of me, I'm overlooking a huge amount of stuff to be more bothered by you than I am by me. Maybe that is what lies behind Paul's words in 1 Timothy when he says, you know, Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the worst. Was Paul the worst sinner? Had he done a survey? That'd be embarrassing, wouldn't it? You do a survey to find out who's the worst sinner of the entire known Christian church, and it's you. Well, it had to be someone. Now, I think Paul is showing this, that when you know how messed up your own heart is, it's very hard to believe there's someone else out there who's more messed up than you are. And if that's our conviction, if that's our posture, we will be people that others feel safe confessing sin to. All that, sorry, was from don't say to someone what you can't say to everyone, but keep showing how Jesus levels the playing field. And his words implicate all of us. Answer narrative with narrative. What has helped to change people's mind on something like gay marriage or gender identity is they keep hearing on repeat a narrative that our culture is offering, that this is the way to fullness and freedom and happiness and joy. And you keep hearing that narrative again and again and again and again and again, and it changes your views. So part of our challenge is to show our friends that there's more than one type of narrative out there, and the church has got some stories too. And maybe they're better ones. So we do need to hear the narratives of Christians coming to terms with different forms of sexual brokenness and finding Jesus to be liberating. But as well as answering narrative with individual narratives, we need to answer narrative with the Bible's mega narrative. And showing how the whole Bible is a romance. It begins with a wedding, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. It ends with the marriage of Christ and his bride in the book of Revelation. And that first marriage is the trailer for the last marriage. And this is why the Bible begins the way it does. It you know, you get Genesis 1 and it's all wide-angle lens and kind of epic and CGI and all the rest of it, special effects going off everywhere. Have you ever wondered why Genesis 2 was suddenly in a garden watching a guy and a girl get together? It's because that's a picture of what the whole Bible is going to be about. Male and female uniting in love becomes a picture of heaven and earth being united through Jesus Christ. And so we begin to realize one of the big themes of the entire Bible is how God is the husband, drawing a bride to himself. And therefore, when Jesus turns up and calls himself the bridegroom, that means something. I heard someone trashing Zoolander earlier, so I'm going to give an illustration from Zoolander, that important cultural artifact. You may know with Zoolander that the premise is that the more good looking you are, the more stupid you are. I find that very offensive, personally. Not to laugh that much. and the main character is Zoolander. He's a male model, so he's profoundly stupid. And there's a scene where they're gonna make a school in his honor, in his name. And they have the architect's model there, and they invite him to come and have a look at the model and see what the school's going to look like. And he walks in, and he looks at the model, and he's angry because he thinks the school's too small. And the stupidity is he's looked at the model, and he thinks that's the real thing. And so he says, is this a school for ants? Now, he's mistaken the model for the real thing. And the big story of the Bible shows us any time we think romantic fulfillment is going to be what completes us, we're doing the same thing. Marriage is not meant to fulfill you. It's meant to point to the thing that can, which is the ultimate marriage between Christ and his bride. So we need to answer the world's narratives, not just with the counter-narratives of the church, but with the meta-narrative of Scripture itself. We need to show people the goodness of God. We talked about that earlier. I'm not going to expand much on that, other than if we don't do that, then God's various commands and prohibitions just look arbitrary. A friend of mine, when his daughter was 2, she embraced the two-ness of being 2 with full gusto. And I remember going around there for dinner once. And sometimes dinner at their house had been a little bit fraught. But I went around there once and he said, hey, don't worry. We've made her favorite thing for dinner tonight. So there's going to be peace in the land. It's going to be okay. And she had said just a few days earlier that spaghetti was her favorite thing. So spaghetti was served. And spaghetti was rejected in somewhat dramatic fashion. And my friend was kind of pulling his hair again. But you told us spaghetti was your favorite, so we made you your favorite. And she said something to the effect of, you know, I reserve the right at any time without prior notice to change what is or is not my favorite. So words to that effect, I'm paraphrasing. But the trouble is, if we don't show people the goodness of God, it feels as arbitrary as that. That God's just randomly decided he doesn't like it when two men are romantically involved, but he's happy when a guy and a girl are romantically involved. It looks arbitrary and fickle. And we need to show there's a rationale here. There's goodness of God behind these prohibitions. Next, we need to keep pointing people to Jesus. Whenever I teach on this evangelistically or doing a one-on-one and this topic comes up, I always try to anchor what I'm saying in the Gospels, not because I don't believe that the whole Bible has the same level of authority, but I really want people to see their issue is Jesus, not me. Their issue is Jesus, not the church. Their issue is Jesus, not some thing abstracted called Christianity. I want them to know that the most loving and tender and just man who ever lived does say these things about sex and marriage. And I want them to know that the only way they're going to change my mind on these issues is by convincing me to no longer be a follower of Jesus. Because I believe what I believe about this stuff because I believe what I believe about Jesus. So when someone says, hey, you can't think that these days, you've got to change your mind, I say to them, well, you're actually telling me to stop following Jesus because he's the one who teaches me these things. And sometimes they'll say, okay, that's fair enough. I didn't know that's what that was. You know, I'm not going to tell you to stop following Jesus. Sometimes someone will say, yeah, okay, you should stop following Jesus then. At which point I say to them, well, can you just tell me what you've got going for you that Jesus doesn't have going for him? So that I'll listen to what you say on this issue and not what he says. And he's died for me and risen again. That's where the bar is currently set. So if you can improve on that, I'm genuinely interested. But I want them to be bothered by Jesus. A friend of mine has on her office wall a little saying that says, those who hear not the music think the dancer's mad. And I want people to realize my life choices are never going to make sense to them unless they understand who Jesus Christ is to me. And then finally, we want to trust in the power of the gospel. Was it Pete earlier who was being interviewed and mentioned Romans 1? Let's just have a quick look at Romans 1. And not the bit of Romans 1 you might think we're going to look at when it comes to this topic. I want us to rewind to verse 8 and following. Romans 1 verse 8 and following, it looks a bit like housekeeping. Paul's kind of doing a bit of, you know, sorry I hadn't come sooner type stuff. But you read between the lines and it becomes very apparent that they thought Paul was reluctant to come to Rome. And we could see why they might think that. Rome was the seat of empire. Rome was the kind of military, you know, center of the known world. They were proud of their Greek philosophy and aspects of Greek culture. This was sophisticated. This is where culture happened. You could see them thinking, well, you know, Paul's been out there in the sticks and the provinces and his shtick seems to work out there, but this is Rome. And Paul hasn't come here. So maybe the gospel just doesn't work here in the same way. They were intimidated themselves by being Christians in Rome. So with that in mind, listen exactly to what Paul says here. It's really interesting. He says, first, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you because your faith is proclaimed in all the world. In other words, you guys are legit. You're legit Christians, and we praise God for that. Then he suddenly gets very solemn and formal. For God is my witness. Okay, you only pull God in as your witness when you're saying something that is like, this is completely on the record, okay? This is really serious. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his son. What is Paul calling God to witness? That without ceasing, I mention you always in my prayers. Now, Paul always prays for those he writes to. He doesn't normally say, hey, God is my witness that I'm always praying for you. He does now because of what it is he's praying. You're always in my prayers, asking that somehow by God's will, I may now at last succeed in coming to you. So Paul is saying, you guys need to know how much I'm praying to be able to join you. You can ask God how much I'm praying about this. Verse 11, for I long to see you that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to strengthen you. In other words, you guys are legit, but you need strengthening. You're genuine Christians, but you're weak. Paul then adds, that is, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. Don't you love the fact that Paul the Apostle expects to find himself encouraged by the faith of these weaker, younger Christians? So much so that he not only says mutually encourage, but he then adds, by each other's faith, both yours and mine. That reciprocity, Paul really highlights. And may the Lord protect us from ever thinking our ministry is one way. Paul then adds, verse 13, I do not want you to become unaware, brothers, that I've often intended to come to you, but thus far have been prevented. Maybe they had a lockdown. Maybe the borders were closed. Maybe Qantas cancelled his flight. I speak from bitter experience. So Paul is saying, listen, I can show you the receipts. I tried to get there. Verse 13, in order that I may reap some harvest among you as well as among the rest of the Gentiles. In other words, I'm expecting the gospel to have the same impact with you guys that it has everywhere. You're not that special. I'm under obligation both to the Greeks, notice that the use of that word, and to barbarians, both to the wise and the foolish. So I'm eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. Paul is saying, I'm not coming there nervous, I'm coming there excited. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Given we can often feel intimidated by our LGBT friends and the kind of cultural power they seem to hold at the moment, we need with Paul to remember that the gospel is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. It doesn't take more miracle and more grace for God to save one of our gay friends than for God to save anybody else. And whilst we see some of these cultural trends and changes and rightly feel a sense of distress about them, we need to know that God isn't on his throne anxious. God isn't there kind of chewing off his fingernails going, man, I kind of knew what we were doing up until now, but now we're in this new cultural moment. I'm stuck. So my friends in ministry, our job when it comes to issues like human sexuality and gender identity, our job is not to hold the line. Our job is to win people for Jesus. And the gospel is the power of God. Jesus is better at saving than people are at sinning. And we want to do all that we can to understand the kind of cultural context we're in and what people are thinking and how they got to where they're thinking. But we don't need to be fully on top of that before God will use us. So let's do what we can to be informed and to understand. But let's not wait until we think we're ready before we start sharing Jesus with our gay friends. My limited experience of doing evangelism in that context tells me that the fields are ripe for harvest. So many friends in that part of our community know that they are lost and are looking for hope.